Mr. Robinson, Real 10. We're talking about your time with the number 26 operational training unit in Buckinghamshire. And you were going to talk about how they put the crews together for the Wellingtons, or your crew.
Well, that's right. Well, our crew is a few days of familiarisation with each other, as well as the equipment and the aircraft and the airfield and the location, all this sort of stuff. It was left to the pilots of the group to choose their crew, and that was for a reason. I think by that time they've got some hours in every aspect you can think of, actually. And in each of the categories, we had met some air gunners for the first time. They'd come back from air gunnery school into the OTU, and we also met bomb aimers who'd come from bomb training school straight to wing. And so therefore, we met a new groups of people that we haven't seen before.
You were no longer an air gunner, you were just a wireless.
It was way back in, soon after I joined, that they changed the category, actually. Yeah. It used to be both, but they realised that whilst the wing was a separate thing. And each of the categories, air competitors, on account, I had someone in charge, a leader of them, as they called it, but similar. Because of my rank, I was the leader of the wireless operators, about 10 of us. And there was a chap in charge of the fire, which I don't know about. And when it came to selection, people made friends at the football ground, or anyway, name it. And therefore they chose people that they knew, they had access to our records, they knew what we'd done and what we could do. And it so happened that the leader of the pilots group chose me for his crew, and he chose the senior navigator, given that privilege. And it's a thing to say that he was an experienced pilot, because he had been previously a Spitfire pilot in the Far East.
Now, what was his name? What was his name?
Colin Steele.
And who were the other members of your crew?
The navigator was,
don't worry.
Sorry, I can't.
That's all right.
I think I'm a human, I only know as Jock. I can't remember what his name was. Tony, he didn't buy Christian, he really needed to use the surnames, but I uncovered somewhere. And got us together, and decided we were going to be a crew. He's quite a formidable character, because he had this experience. He decided to become to transfer the bombers, he said, because he felt a bit lonely in a single engine aircraft by himself in the Middle East. And he'd been an ex-Horton apprentice, so he'd been in the Air Force quite a long time. And as it turned out, he was a very good pilot, because our initial flying with him, when we started to do flying exercises, it was circuits and landings, not cross-country flights, just to get the aircraft around the circuit and back onto the runway. And this we kept going round and round for about 2 hours at a time, and all got the fell up with it. But so it's one of the things we had to do. And he had a staff pilot sitting with him. We didn't have a navigator staff, and we didn't need a staff wireless operator, so we were supposed to be able to cope with that, which obviously we could. But unfortunately, when experience here was that this problem was, imagine you've got a staff pilot sitting next to you saying, put the nose down, but now bring it up a bit, put it down, bits to the left, bits to the right. And he thought, well, I can do this myself, I was sitting in the other seat. He asked us that if you do this better, we'll get someone to do this. And each time, with the chap sitting next to him, we missed a long way. And went onto the grass, imagine a heavy bomber landing on the grass, plowing it through the wet field where it was, and coming to a halt. And then we'd be the most unpopular crews there, whilst the ground staff had to dig the aircraft out and get it back into the maintenance area. And so we went on like this for, I don't know, about 20 flights, probably going around like this. And eventually he got near to the runway, and we came off the runway several times onto the grass, and we all felt a little bit nervous about when eventually the staff over said, well, what do you do? Nothing more I can do. You take it down yourself this time and make sure you get on the Monday this time. And I can only to say that from then onwards, we never in on the bus at all, on the wrong way, perfectly every time, perfect landing every time. In a rather antiquated aircraft that we're getting a bit old by then compared to some of the Lancers and whatnot, we're fairly new. But every time it was perfect. And I never needed help staff, staff navigators, so we were a follow-up. And after we finished the circuits and landings, we do that bit. It was decided that we should now do cross-country flights. And these now were still the 3, 4, 5 hour trips. That's 5 hours, five one time, in those days. And every day and night. And they take us out right over the North Sea. And not far off the Dutch coast and this sort of thing. We'd be in enemy territory virtually without necessarily being shot at or anything like that. Not near enough to the enemy coast to Dutch lies in these early days. And then, of course, we had to go to proper briefings, not to sort of pick up the flags and off it goes stuff. It was a proper briefing, as you say in the movie terms nowadays, where you stand and the CO comes in to tell you where you're going. So we did it exactly as if you were going on operation, which is the idea of the operation training. And then you'd have a full briefing there of where the so-called imaginary target was, where you dropped a bomb somewhere. Most of the bombs were dropped in this country, especially the selected sites, supposedly remote sites, such as they are in England, where you dropped bombs on a target there, and there's a little poor chap sitting in the ground there, in a concrete hut, watching them drop and telling you where they fell. And these were actual bombs you were dropping, not practice bombs. They were not the big heavy ones like they dropped later on, but nevertheless, they were quite well done, and I should explain later. Anyway, so you did this, decided you were going to do this cross country, have this briefing. Now, after the main briefing, you went to your individual category briefing, while it's a regular briefing, and you were given the necessary maps and the charts. And there we were introduced to Bomber Command Code, where everything was conducted in a four-letter code for each word. It's the plain language, as we've had before. If you want to send a message, you send it in one for one code, which changes every day. They're going to have the correct code reader. You're also introduced to the varied pistol, which is fixed in the roof of the aircraft, so you can fire off identification the colours of the day, so it's going to be cool. And it's mostly one common code that was the new thing. It has four letter code, and it's quite easy to find the word and put it into the code, but it's quite difficult to translate it back. But you never had to do that, but you mostly sending messages. If you are recalled, you get that in plain language. No point in being out of code, really. But we're never recalled. We had to return sometimes for various reasons, but no recall, so no question. No matter the opportunity to try and decode something, fortunately. But you have to make sure each day you've got the right code, otherwise, you'll be on the ground and know what it's all about.
And what was this G? You mentioned G radio. G
radar. Yeah.
What's that?
Aid. It was the first, probably the first, but the first one in an aircraft where you couldn't on a cathode ray tube, relatively small, press a few buttons and work out your position by it. And the charts you had looked very much like a weather chart with the isobars, and looked very much like that. It was done with elliptical circles. Ellipses from various points where the radar stations were, and these ellipses crossed over each other in various places, and you could from this work out exactly where they were, very much like low pressure weather chart. It's quite simple to operate, but the navigator did it most of the time. We had to learn to use it, as we had to learn. Part of our training at the station was to learn how to do other people's jobs. in case one, you know, theory was in case one injured or something like that, or whatever.
So which jobs did you learn?
Well, I had to do more, but I was sending a turret on one occasion, and the fire guns at the back in the air, over the sea, and these Tesla guns over the sea. And on one occasion, I had to do, you navigated that, but I was sitting in his seat, and he showed me some of the simple things he had to do there. And I had an occasion to fly the plane around the circuit as well, not land it, but I never do that. So I was pleased with that. But just take it down the circuit and to know what it was like to handle it, so you could at least do something. And that was a victory of my feet, hardly reached the rudder bars actually there, but you cope with that a lot easier. Don't bother about the rudder bars, so just take it down. And then I also have about 2 hours in the Link Trainer, as it's called. That's the what would be called a simulator, a pilot simulator now. Very similar to the one you see in the museums and whatnot. And it's really for night flying training. And they pull over the top, so you can't see any of the instruments. And it works a lot of things like a crab that crawled over on that. On the table by the Japanese monitoring all this. So I had a couple of hours in that, which was quite interesting. You can do very well in there. I don't think I could have gone for the pilot really for that reason. And so all these other things suddenly were put on us. It made us, I think it made me, I think gosh, actually, we felt suddenly more responsible. We were in charge of an aircraft. And whatever went wrong with it, and our fault, maybe, might be something. As it turned out, of course, we have occasion where an engine packed up, the twin engine aircraft, and one packed up, and we found that when we got back afterwards, that the coil of wire left in it by an electrician. Not a very big one, but enough to do the engine a lot of damage. Another occasion at a fire on board where my
what happened there? Could you tell us that story? Could you tell us that story?
Yes, I found the radio had gone dead, and I wondered what had happened. I went through the various checks that one had to do, various things. It wasn't the more electrical, so I probably set out of the place to look and thrown and shut up all over the place. So the idea was if something happened, you throw it out of the aircraft, then what's time to do is I'll push it back in the case, thinking I'll exclude the air from it, that might put fire out, which it did. And of course, we were out of the North Sea at the time, and I told the captain this and the skipper, and the rule was if the radio packs up, we would send them straight away to base, which we had to do. So that was actually that exercise of playing those with. And I went back later to the where they did the repairs to sets, and there was some malfunction in the set, which I think they threw the set away anyway. And then there's spare ones there. But because aircraft will be coming out themselves with a war engine, they just said, well, let's not spend a lot of time servicing aircraft when we might not need them. If it was going to finish in Europe, perhaps we don't need them anymore in this country. And so, it came down the end of the 20 aircraft we had, we were down to about 8 that were actually serviceable. And we never used the same aircraft each time necessarily. They had to have about 4 or 5 serviceable at any one time.
Now, you were meant to finish the course with a practice raid. Could you tell us about that? Because I think it was canceled.
Well, yes, the idea of this was, operation training was that. That you'd be available, you'd be skilled enough or equipped enough or you'd learned enough to get you to a foreign country and back. And you knew exactly what you had to do, and indeed, this is what happened in the 1,000 bomber raids earlier that chaps from OTUs all took part in the 1,000 bomber raids and make up the numbers. And they may not have gone the whole distance as some of the bigger ones, but they certainly took part. So therefore, you have to be prepared, perhaps, for something like this. And the idea was you finish the course with an actual raid on the island of Sylt, which is off the Heligoland Bay, and I think that's why LT, I think. And this place, I think, was unoccupied, actually. They may have had a couple of guns on it, but there was nothing of the military time as such. So there was an unrestricted call there on the verse. And so they used this as a playing thing for OT, so you get a fear of what you're up against. So it wasn't like Hamburg and in some sort of place they were heavily defended. This wasn't. But someone could fire, actually. The only person to be able to fire at us was a British ship. We were out over in North Sea again on an exercise and saw I can see it, but the Twitter side of this vessel in the North Sea, which we hadn't been told about. We're now briefing, we're told of what should be in the various places. And we saw this destroyer, as it turned out to be, was British spot in the sea below us. And it's, I think we've got to get down and have a look at it. I said, I think we ought to report it by the idea. Because we're going over as we're here, so exactly what it is. As we descended to circle around us, we saw them getting ready to fire at them. Indeed, they fired off a couple of shots at us, and I was told to fire off our identification colours out of the aircraft. Because I've never fired a very pistol before, and I have to show these things from the couch and about that thing. I think it's silly, isn't it? I hear it go off, but you can't hear the sound inside the aircraft, it's so noisy. And just now it's gone off and the smoke sort of comes back, actually. And they stopped firing after that, so we worked out it was a British destroyer either out of place, or perhaps we were, but we had to report it when we went back to it. We had a debriefing when we got back exactly as if we'd been on a normal way. And they asked you where you've been, what you've seen, what you've done, and they tell me a log book and check all sorts of things. And as if you actually. But the bombs were dropped on a target. One of you used for that was in Manchester. And on one occasion at night, for some reason which I never found out, we missed the target and hit the main line. just between Manchester and London. And blew up a bit of a truck. And that didn't make it very popular, actually. And all sorts of questions were asked, so asking us, where the hell are they, what are you doing, and you look at the rocks and all this sort of stuff. And there's just navigation error of some sort somewhere along the line, or the bombing, I made a mistake. We all said, we're totally sorry. It didn't make us terribly popular with the people in Manchester at the time. The way they wanted to have it, that's why they wanted it. Well, I didn't go to wave or anything like that. It was blowing up the track. So that was so that had first class experience of blowing somebody up from an aircraft there. The other thing is, of course, here we have to do wet thing we do as well. But now, getting out of an aircraft, the other thing I forgot to mention is that for the first time at Bishop's Hall and here, we are using our own flying kit because at Yatesbury, the aircraft was so small there, you couldn't put the full kit on. So here we were allowed to use our own flying kit. But we never had our own chute. We had to. Indeed, we were told how to. We had to pack a chute and take it for the training station. That was a part of the training. You have to see how a chute is packed. You show how to do it and you do it. And I said, well, you take it with you now. So if you had to use it, then it's one you did. You make sure it works all right.
And what was the flying kit?
Well, the flying kit was. Thermal underwear, that we call thermal underwear now, but it was long john type trousers and things, and a very thick dress. On top of that was a quilted silk type garment, which was like an eiderdown actually, and on top of that was the exterior, I don't know what it's made of, a very thick linen suit, literally heated. There's wires all running through it, and that sort of stuff. Plus helmets, of course. The helmets we wore all the time because the earphone is fitted into the side piece of the helmet. And we had flying boots, which varied in various types of way. And the ones we had were suede, with a leather apple, so you can cut the top off the suede if you're a prisoner of war, or the wailed out over chain, you cut the top and wear it back shoes and put some new clothes on. Hopefully, in all this sort of theory, but no technique, hopefully. And we had five pairs of gloves, which couldn't wear more, all of them all the time, but for varying circumstances, a silk pair, a suede pair, a woolen pair, and a big leather gauntlet, and another pair, which was a cotton leather glove. Now, I never found out, and I never told what they all were for. You'd beat yourself up to which ones you wanted to use. But mostly the leather gauntlets, because they were electrically heated as well. If you want to, I never used the electrical heating. Didn't need to. I was sitting in the ships and heating the engine things never failed, so I never needed to use the air gun, of course, you used the people in which had the air gun. Only if it packed up, did one need to use the whole clothing. And we had oxygen masks, and which we used all the time. Over 10,000 feet, we had to use oxygen. And we mostly flew here back when, about 25,000 feet. The aircraft in Birmingham, that was the reason for that, wasn't it? any other reason, that was the maximum I could go. Very good aircraft. We had an occasion where we took up some air training cadets with us, they did a bit of thing there, and had a couple of our aircraft, and everyone had about two or three of them. And we were doing, that particular day, we were practicing a single engine flying. They failed to tell these chaps what they're doing. So they got rather nervous because they saw one engine pop up, and I explained to them, well, it's a normal training, but I didn't believe it. And then we started to do some what's called corkscrew rolls, which was the tactics you took to get away from the fighter aircraft chasing them, which meant putting down one wing very steeply on the nose at the same time. And then coming up the other wing when we got to the bottom of the roll and coming up the other way and going over the top and going on spiraling virtually all the way without actually turning over doing that sort of movement. And we did that, and they were a bit worried about that. There was something going on there, so I explained that's what it is there. And then we had what was called flash retaliation, where the Spitfires came into effect there. And they had to fly around a chosen course, and the Spitfires would come in and attack us. And our air gun was fired back at them with a camera gun like that. And afterwards, we ran a sort of films that were taken by the Spitfires and by us to see exactly what went wrong, if we were okay. And generally speaking, it wasn't too bad, really. These were 8-mark 12 Spitfires, kept winging sort, very fast, very maneuverable. And only just turned them on the airfield, but we only did this perhaps once a week for certain things, just to get a feel of the thing. The other thing I had for the first time was a trailing aerial. I knew that one existed in aircraft, but all the other aircraft previously never had anything. And the trailing aerial went out about 250 feet, something like that. And the idea of that was if you're at altitude in those days, this gave you a greater range, and it was also sort of all of a sudden frequency band. What the snag was that it's right down the back of the aircraft, so you had to unplug the oxygen mask and run that hill down the back. So it wasn't a risk oxygen lack, it was so easy to do. And so we used to run down, I unfortunately could run down the catwalk that existed down the aircraft and plug into the nearest oxygen supply there. And then wheel this aircraft, it was air allowed, it was just purely a stainless steel wire, twisted wire, plastic, paper, which went up the way from Canada. And that was fine until during a storm, I had to wheel it in because of the storm. And the sparks were flying over the place and got pepper vapor in the aircraft. I felt a bit nervous about that. The sparks were flying over, nothing you can do about it. You've got to get the aerial in safer at the end than anything else. And the other thing, you have to remember to wheel it in after each flight, because if you didn't, they will catch in telephone wires or something and look after the aircraft. Some would have precipitated when the aircraft down, but when they would just snap off of the feeling. And the other thing we had to learn to do was there was a bunk arrangement halfway down the aircraft for injured people, flying operation. and you had to learn how to give morphine to get rid of the morphine tube. So your general first aid there, there's not much you can do except supply morphine. That's the first thing you're doing, shove a label around there, next thing you're giving it what time, which day, and this sort of stuff, so the medics could sort of that when you're landing. So unfortunately, never had to do this, like just showing what to do by the medical people. And jab it in any way you could, really, wherever was available, I don't think. So to find a way and all this stuff, or anything. But, and in practice, the chapter time to do all that, really. It didn't matter too much what to do, and it was a really great thing. And actually, the other few things that we came across here. The other aspect of flying here was that this, the aircraft was considered to be in those days an all weather aircraft, although in practice one couldn't really consider it that because of in the day, thick kindling was clearly when the ground was over the place, the wings of the head were battering and sometimes ripped off in some aircraft. But you had to fly at whatever you were instructed to do. Or get permission to change as aircraft do nowadays. And the next week we have a briefing, and I've given a briefing about the weather conditions, which I can honestly say on one occasion the chap looked out the window and said, well, I think it's going to be fairly fine where you're going. It's a technical disability quid, and I was going to be like, out of the North Sea. Well, as far as I know, he said, but I think it's going to be quite a visibility, it's going to be, well, it's not all that bad, but it's very vague thing which gave us a rather unfortunate downgrading of Met Office. But the only one who behaved like that, I was generally quite good. On one occasion, well, more than one occasion, on two occasions, I had to go up on the flight with a Met Officer. Not with the same crew, but with a staff crew, to fly in bad weather, to send details back. By the way, then, it's what the weather situation is like in various parts. But when I took the first one I did, it didn't occur to me if we're going to fly in bad, or fly in the weather, we're going to fly in all sorts of awful conditions, which of course we did. Now, it's very difficult to hang on to the aircraft with one hand and send a message to the other. But the Met officer, the woman, the Met officer, and she sat where I was and gave me the details, which I had to put into bomber codes when he. One of the times I used it, and brought the code and sent it back. It relayed to all the other stations what the weather was like. Sent it to hell, the ground station. Nowadays, they've got weather people, mostly at RAF stations, they've got weather people there. So that was another thing we came across here, which we haven't had to worry about elsewhere. And I think that covers all the
Now the silt raid was cancelled, wasn't it, for you?
Yes, that's right. What happened? We finished everything else, and we were told you're next up to do this. So we thought, no, great, that'll be fun. Or otherwise, we thought, no, it's probably the truth. And not knowing, it would be unknown again. And suddenly they said, well, the war in Europe's finished. There's nothing, no more raids likely to be carried out either than most of those still existing desert in various places. But we're not going to bother now, we're going to keep four aircraft operational, and the other four, we're going to not bother to maintain them. So there'll only be a limited amount of flying training done to carry on doing what you've been doing until you're here further. But you might have to go to the Far East.
Were you disappointed to miss this raid, or...?
Well, I suppose at that time I might have answered yes to that question, but now I would say no, not really. If, as I said, it wasn't a position there, then maybe it would be interesting to fly out another country, perhaps, and see what it was like. But not really, I guess. By that time, when the war finishing, the idea of the war was disappearing out of people's minds a little bit there. We were thinking, well, if it's only going to be a short while longer, do we need to do all this sort of stuff? It's interesting doing the cross-country flights, the five-hour night flights, particularly I found it very interesting, really. There are lots to do, and nothing to say, but lots to do, and it was a good fun, and you got yourself around all the around a big area, a much bigger area than previously, and the oxygen itself rather than helping the brain.